So we're still in silence until the end of lunch. And this afternoon we have groups and then a period of meditation. And this evening we'll have more devotion to Avalokiteshvara. Well, just a reminder, if you're offering night lights, can you be sure to put them on the slates, not on the black plastic? And this evening, if you want to make an offering, you could think of it as well as an offering of devotion and appreciation for the three jewels. You could think of it as an offering of something that you're going to do, an action that you're going to take, an action of body, speech, or mind, or any combination, arising from this retreat, arising from taking yourself more seriously as a Dharma practitioner, arising from having really gone into the reasons why Dharma practice is the only way to bring suffering to an end, and is the only way that our heart's longing for freedom is ever going to be fulfilled. So it would be good, arising out of that, to think of something which you're going to do, which will add to the momentum of your Dharma life. You know, might be big, might be small. But it would be good to make it very specific. When I make these sorts of very strong intentions, I make them very clear. You know. Unless I'm ill, every day I'm going to do such and such. Or unless I'm ill or I'm travelling, every day I'm going to do such and such. Yeah. And for this set period of time. And then I'm going to review it. And I'm also going to keep in touch with this person or tell my chapter that I'm doing it. And I will also tell my chapter if it's all getting very thin, or if I don't manage to do it. So make it really, really clear in your mind, if you'd like to. It may be that now doesn't feel like quite the right time to clarify something, or there might be some sort of bigger step that you want to take, or you feel you might want to take. Part of you might not, but a lot of you does, you know, arising out of the retreat. So what you offer might be, I'm going to go home and I'm going to talk to my chapter, I'm going to talk to this person, that person, and I'm really going to look at whether it would be the best thing to do such and such. You get the idea. Okay, so let's start with a little more time spent with Avalokiteshvara. So as usual, we'll call to mind our situation, and then we'll have the Avalokiteshvara mantra. I'll cue Bodhinaga in when the moment comes. While the mantra is going on, Satyajyoti will make an offering on behalf of all of us. So we're within the mandala, wanting to become more and more absorbed in the qualities of awakening. And Bhante says that what prevents us from becoming absorbed in meditation is because our energy isn't in the right configuration, it's not in the right way. Either it's blocked, or it's scattered, or it's not refined enough to meditate. So we're still protected by the three circles. So let's take our awareness out. Until we come to the soft, open lotuses. Very pure, very beautiful. Very soft. And they encourage our energy to become more refined. Open to beauty. To more subtle levels of experience. And then there's the Vajra womb. All the qualities of the thunderbolt and the diamond. So the Vajra wall is full of energy. But it's completely stable. Protects us from scattering our energy. Beyond the Vajra wall is the great ring of flames. Flickering, dancing, searing. These wisdom flames energy blockages. And particularly what blocks our energy is this deeply held belief that we're a separate, isolated self. The wisdom burns that up. We're seated together within the mandala. Part of one community. Part of one practice. A practice that benefits all of us. Practice that benefits the world. And symbolically, we're all facing towards the center of the mandala. Becoming more and more absorbed, more and more open to the qualities of awakening. Now appearing particularly in the form of Avalokiteshvara. Whole mandala filled with his radiance, filled with his love and compassion. So we'll chant the mantra, and with each recitation we take in more of his qualities, we become closer to him. And while that's going on, will be the offering on behalf of all of us.
Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om.
letting the mantra carry on sounding internally. Continuing to take in the influence, the adhisthana of Avalokiteshvara. Letting his compassion dissolve away any tension, any holding on, any closing down. No need. And as our hearts open more, we can become a channel for that love, those qualities of Avalokiteshvara to go out to everyone here. With the sound of the mantra, radiating out. And then we all become a channel for the great love and compassion to go out in all directions, to wherever it's needed. Carried by the mantra, in all directions, into all realms. as more beings are come into contact with the mantra, their suffering, their self-clinging is liberated. Their hearts open. They participate in the practice. Become transmitters of the mantra. Until the mantra is everywhere, sounding in all directions. Great love everywhere, in all directions. And this will just continue like a puja that never ends. We can withdraw our attention from it. Just just rest. So this is the last of these sessions, and yesterday, what happened yesterday in these sessions? Oh, yes. Yesterday I answered a question from an orange. We also had that story about Kalu Rinpoche and the Korean Zen master, which kind of pointed to the fact that we really do need a common language and common ways of approaching things. And I also answered a question about romance and sexual attraction, and went into various ways you could look at that, including listing of unhooking from the object, unhooking from the subject, unhooking from a concept of anger or metta or whatever it was. And we did that meditation where we were breathing out into space, letting go, letting go, letting go. And in the afternoon we looked at the fourth reminder that we're never going to fix mundane life. We just aren't. It is going to end in tears. Everything is going to come apart. So the only reason why it won't end in tears is if we've really found the stability and the wisdom and the qualities of awakening, so that we're not basing our happiness on it. Just like in the Parinirvana, there are lots of disciples who are in tears and distraught, really upset. But then there are those who really have seen how things are and have just based their lives on that, and they're not upset. So yeah, we looked at how mundane life isn't finally going to give us what we want. Even if it works out well, we're still left with the second and third levels of dukkha. We're still left with the potential dukkha of holding on to what we want. And potential dukkha always becomes actual dukkha, because sooner or later we do lose whatever it is, and at that point we suffer. And then there's that third level of dukkha where we're still operating with a sense of being separate from everything else. And that sort of deep dukkha is the one we really need to resolve. So we also looked at that, how, you know, we tend to sort of freeze the frame just at the point where we've got to the happy ending. We imagine getting whatever it is that we think, you know, that's what we need. And we just stop there. And we don't carry on. We don't press the resume button and see. But then life goes on. And then, so what happens? And we did that kind of laboratory meditation where we imagined something that we craved and explored that a bit. I mean, having done that, we might still feel, well, actually, objectively, it's, you know, it would be helpful and beneficial to have that thing. The issue is the craving. And with craving, we overestimate the positive qualities of something. With aversion, we overestimate the negative. So that was all yesterday afternoon, and in general, we spent the last few days looking at integration through focusing, well, in a way, kind of creating a personal mandala which has the qualities of awakening at its centre. And that's what we're going to be able to integrate all our energy around. And that's what will satisfy our deepest heart wish, our deepest yearning, our deepest longing, is to know, to understand, to be loved, to be free, to be peaceful, and so on. So if we can come into contact with what our heart really longs for, and then we put in the centre of our mandala what can really satisfy it, and we stay in touch with our existential situation, seeing that life is a real opportunity, but it's a limited offer, and how we act creates a world, it creates a momentum. Positive. So we aim to create a positive momentum which builds and builds. Even if it feels like it's building from a very low base, that doesn't really matter. The fact is we just keep adding to it and adding to it and adding to it. 5 minutes more practice a day is over 30 hours more practice in the course of a year. And yes, we also need to stop having to drag with us on the path lots of things which just really hold us back. And one of those is that sort of still deeply held idea that if we can just get, you know, our mundane mandala just nice, then we'll really be happy. Well, we may be happy on a certain level, but things will change and there are still those deeper levels of dukkha to deal with. So in a way this week we've been looking at quite, in a sense, sort of basic teachings, basic kind of right view. But the Dharma path, if we see it in terms of a path, is a spiral path. And it's the spiral path not just in the sense that we spiral up through the positive nidanas, although we can do. It's a spiral in the sense that we keep coming to the same point, but further on in the path. So there are fundamental sanskaras, you know, sort of certain tendencies that we have, that we'll keep finding again and again and again, but we'll go deeper and deeper into them, and we'll liberate more and more energy each time we do. and we'll free ourselves from them more and more. But there'll be certain things which will just keep coming back. And also, we'll keep coming back to the same understandings and either understand them more deeply or more clearly, or simply just get more of ourselves behind them. It's like we get more of the crowd behind the understanding. So, whatever, yes, we know everything's impermanent. But how many of our crowd actually know that or acting as if everything's impermanent? So, yes, I've first heard that teaching whenever it was, way back when. And then as the years went by, various things taught me that my understanding of impermanence hadn't gone very deep. So deaths of my parents and things like that. I realised there were bits of me that hadn't really heard that teaching at all. But gradually, as time goes by, we take these things in deeper and deeper and deeper. And that's in a way the crucial thing. If we can just get the basics of the Dharma really deep, that will be fantastic. Bhante has this thing about there are no higher teachings, just deeper understandings. And in various ways this week, we've been touching on at least integrating all the different aspects of ourselves, our different faculties, our different abilities. So we brought awareness into the body, to the emotions and the feelings, what to the Vedanas, to the feelings and emotions. We've done a little bit with views and with including thoughts in meditation. We've used imagination in some ways, and all this has been, we've also, perhaps not very consciously, been working with spiritual intuition. So, I've still got a few questions here. I've been doing fairly well, although I see I've got another few in my begging bowl overnight, which I may or may not be able to get to. And last but not least, two of them. My goodness. We'll see if one way or another we can answer. It may not be in this session. Let's do this one. On the first day, you mentioned how staying in connection with one another could lead to an ultimately deeper integration. So I was talking about, well, we could just do a very sort of intensive retreat where we just all went deeply into our own experience and we walked around sort of eyes down and didn't engage with one another at all. But yes, I said that practicing in the way that we have been could lead to a deeper integration. Could you say more about that? It sounds like one of my sources of inspiration. Thanks, Nat. Yeah, so how does staying in connection promote integration? I guess there are quite a few different levels to it. There's a certain level just of kind of psychological and emotional integration. It's like just keeping awareness of lots of different kinds of people, has an effect. I had a period of some years where I was overall order convener at a time when there were a bit less than 1,000 order members. So I spent a lot of time travelling around the world, meeting order members in all kinds of situations, different nationalities, people who were in quite comfortable situations, people who were living in hutments in Pune, all kinds of things. And some of them were quite similar to me, and some were very, very different. Different kinds of personality, much more introverted or extroverted or this kind of person. And so I had to find ways to get into communication with them. And it's also part of my job in a way, where sometimes I was sort of like parachuted into areas where there were difficulties in the order. So I'd be trying to understand people so that we could resolve those. I realized one of the things that I really got from doing that was how much I'd grown in my ability to empathize, and also how I had developed new qualities in myself. And it's almost like, to start with, there were some people I almost didn't know how to meet. It's like we completely missed one another. They lived in such a different world. They created such a different world for themselves. But over time, because we really needed to communicate, and I really wanted to, I would have to kind of, as it were, grow a new bit in order to meet them. I'd have to grow a more intuitive bit, or a more emotional bit, or a more rational bit, or a more imaginative bit, or whatever it was. And as a result, I felt very, very fortunate being in that position, because I really broadened as a person. So there's that, you just being aware of one another has that effect. But I suppose when I said that, I had something much deeper in mind. Maybe I can just talk a little bit about deeper levels of integration. Part of all this is, well, it's about that third level of dukkha, about feeling cut off, isolated, and so on. Feeling ourselves to be a separate subject. So years ago, Bhante gave a talk about alienated and integrated awareness. So his basic premise, basically what he said, was that we all start from a level of not being very conscious, and so then we, as we become more individual, as we become a bit more developed, we become more conscious, but we sort of become self-conscious in a way that's isolated. And you can kind of almost separate out, as it were, the awareness from experience too much. So you have a kind of, you experience yourself as a subject, as an awareness, really at a distance from experience. So some people in the early days, not with Triratna, but in other groups in the UK, they would be doing very intensive, very, very intensive Vipassana retreats with not the greatest guidance, perhaps. And some of them would get into these very sort of strange, sort of alienated states where they were kind of watching themselves. So you can have an alienated awareness where, I feel, I am raising my hand and I'm kind of watching my hand, from somewhere in the back of my head. So I'm very alienated from the experience. So the Bantu said, well, you know, that isn't what we want. You know, what we want is an integrated awareness where we're much more actually in the experience. You know, this awareness is in the experience. And thankfully, there's, you see, very little alienated awareness around, I think, these days in Sri Ratna, in the order, partly because of Bhante's great emphasis on positive emotion. But still, there's a whole spectrum from alienated to integrated awareness, and we usually still have some way to go. Yeah. Awareness, it's not really kind of split so that we're experiencing everything, you know, in that distant, alienated way, but we're still at a stage where there's a sense of an aware subject, you know, me, the meditator, seeing how the meditation is going. You know? Me, the meditator, aware of the breathing. Yeah, that's good and that's necessary. But our aim is to transcend, see through that split that we make between awareness and experience, awareness and what appears in awareness, until there is just aware experience. Yeah. So when the hand raises, there isn't any sense of me somewhere here raising the hand. There's just a hand raising with total awareness in it. Yeah. So if we're no longer sitting on the bank, sort of looking at the flow of life, we are that flow. Yeah. But that flow has become completely aware. So that would be the final kind of goal, if you like, of integration. Bhante talks about four dimensions of mindfulness, and awareness of self, awareness of other people, awareness of the environment, and awareness of reality. So if we complete the path, then there will be awareness of all those dimensions, but not from some separate standpoint. So to speak, there will just be a field of awareness. And in that field of awareness, we won't feel separate from other beings. There won't be an us here, you know, sort of feeling separate. And there won't be other beings as objects out there. So it's as if we shall feel deeply connected with all experience. You know, we'll feel completely back in the flow of life. So we kind of move in that direction by going from a sense of separate me to increasingly including, opening our heart to, opening our awareness to other beings and everything that's around. So, in this retreat, we've been within the mandala together, practicing together, moving from a sense of the, you know, me with my retreat, which is what it would be if we did just one of those closed, eyes down things, into a sense of us practicing, we are practicing, and increasingly into a sense of collective practice, which eventually becomes a sense of one practice. So we're actually moving closer to reality when we do this. Yeah? We're integrating more experience. So we integrate when we lose that sense of me and me and others, then there's a field of awareness which includes all of us. So then we naturally care for everything. We naturally care for everyone, because there isn't any separation. Yeah? So then we look after what we usually think of as me. We look after everyone else. We look after the environment. And as it were, we look after the Buddha. We open to reality. We open to the Adhisthana of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, until eventually, again, there is no separation. There's not me devoted to Avalokiteshvara. There's just, well, eventually there's just Avalokiteshvara, if you like, which is why in the Buddhist tradition, there are self-visualizations. Self-visualization is a practice in taking where we're going to end up on the path as the path. We train by in imagination, bringing about the result that we want. So, this week, sitting within the mandala, on an imaginative level, we're aiming to have a vision of total integration, which would be total awakening, in which everything is pervaded by the qualities of awakening. Everything centers around those. Everyone is part of one field of awareness. We're all practicing together without any sense of separation. We're of different bodies, Lord, but only one mind, I think. And when we've done that, we will have created a Buddha field. So that's all rather grand, but we start with us. We just start, it's like we aim to save all beings, and you don't worry about all beings, you just look after the ones you're with. And you keep doing that, and you gradually build that momentum. So we have a vision of Sangha, we have a vision of ourselves as someone who one day will not be just closing down around me, but will have a completely open heart. And then we just keep doing what we can, taking one step after another, one positive action after another, to move in that direction. And the momentum builds. Yeah, so having a retreat where we stay at one, aware of one another, and we have some sense that, yes, we're not just practicing for ourselves. That's our starting point. And that deepens and deepens and deepens and deepens and deepens until we have an Arya Sangha, or we have a Buddha field, however you want to see it. Just do one more very quickly, I think, for now. Is it necessary or helpful to cultivate the dhyanas, to see through the illusion of self and reduce grasping and ill will? Is it necessary or helpful to cultivate dhyana in order to see through the illusion of self and reduce grasping and ill will? Well, the short answer to that, as far as I'm concerned, and different Buddhist traditions would say different things perhaps, is that it's very helpful, but it's not necessary. In order to see through the illusion of self, you need a certain amount of clarity to see what's there. But the sort of clarity that you can have in access concentration should do it. Which I think can come as a relief to, you know, people's capacity, ability to find their way into dhyana varies a lot, and can also vary at different times in your life, actually. So, yeah, sometimes the logic goes, well, there's no point thinking about insight because, you know, I can't even get into dhyana. And you can also get people who get very focused on getting into dhyana, and it becomes another sort of ego project. It's another way of reinforcing a sense of self. So yeah, we can all cultivate insight, and we can all look at grasping and ill will and work against that in all sorts of ways without being able to be deeply absorbed. But if we can find our way into deeper, more absorbed states, well, for some of the time, that will be very helpful. And it's good in itself, obviously. The mind is calm, it's relaxing. There's joy and positive pleasure, which we need. We really need to, we need to enjoy the Dharma life to keep ourselves motivated, keep ourselves emotionally behind it. And it also helps with insight, because firstly, it's much easier to see what's really going on when our mind is very clear. And also, the insight takes more. It fixes better, because at the time that we saw whatever we saw, there was more integration. Going back to my crowd analogy, if the members of the crowd who are really into the Dharma, they kind of call a meeting and they want to give a Dharma talk about, you know, how things are, is that nothing has any essential nature. If 10 of the crowd come, okay, that affects those 10, but all the rest are, they're still believing all kinds of other stuff. But if you kind of invite everyone to a concert and, you know, 75 of them come, and at the end of that you give a little Dharma talk where you explain that nothing has any self-nature, then 75 of them have heard it. So it has more effect. Let's do a little bit of meditation. Just a few minutes. So now relaxing into the earth, still on that Vajra seat. Energy coming up through the body. This is relaxed awareness. So we've been working with the breathing in all sorts of different ways. We'll just do one more little exercise involving imagination and the breathing. So coming into the body, feeling how it is. Becoming aware of the breathing. How is it now? Now we'll do something which uses imagination. It has a flavor of the elements practice, which also can be quite healing. Bringing awareness into the whole body. And bringing to mind the earth element. With each in-breath, we take in the essence of the earth element into the body. And if it helps, we can imagine yellow light coming into the body. It can come in through all the pores. So we're breathing in all that stability, all that strength. There's no need to hold on to it, just no sense of having to store it. So let it come and let it go. As it comes into the body, it strengthens all the solid aspects of the body. It strengthens the bones, the muscles, and so on. Whatever needs to be firm. Now we become aware of the water element. The flowing quality, pure streams. The great ocean. And we breathe it in. If we like, we can imagine white light flowing into us through all the pores of our skin. Feeling this water element healing and supporting the water element in the body, the blood flow, the lymphatic system, and so on. Now we do the same with the fire element. All that warmth of the sun and so on. We breathe in the essence of the fire element. If we like, we can imagine that as red light coming in through all our pores. The sense that this fire element is helping the body, helping regulate temperature, helping in processes like digestion, and so on. Become aware of the air element. And we invite the essence of the air element come in with the breathing. If it helps, imagine green light. Entering the whole of the body. Healing and supporting the whole respiratory system, everything in the body, which is involved with the air element. The oxygen supply to different parts of the body and so on. lastly, we become aware of the space element. Like vast blue sky. When we breathe in the essence of the space element, and if we want, we can see it as blue light flowing into the body. Healing and supporting anything that's tight, constricted, and finally we rest, not trying to do anything, letting life happen, just aware of the effects of the practice.